The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Well, Nicola Sturgeon has let slip that the Joint Committee on Vaccinations is likely to approve vaccines for all over 16s in the UK. James, is this a surprise?
Yeah, well, we know there's been a controversy over the JCVI's decision. At the moment, the JCVI have said that they only think that teenagers who are particularly susceptible to getting seriously ill from COVID should be vaccinated, or who live with an immunosuppressed person. But we know that there is kind of growing concern about this with schools coming back. Schools obviously come back sooner in Scotland than they do in the rest of the UK. And we know the Scottish Government have written to the JCVI saying, are we sure that this is the right approach? And from what Nicola Sturgeon said today, announcing the further easing of COVID restrictions in Scotland, it seems that the JCVI will soon recommend the vaccination of everyone over the age of 16. At the moment, they're vaccinating everyone, those people who are within a few months of their 18th birthday. I think a concern among kind of all the various governments in the UK is that when schools return, cases will come up. Because you have a large number of unvaccinated young people mixing together. And I think it is, if you do end up vaccinating 16 plus, that obviously reduces that risk in certain settings. It also helps. One of the other reasons why this vaccinating of teenagers has become such an issue is that the Delta variant has led to people thinking that what one might call the herd immunity threshold is higher than had been previously thought. And that means that there is more benefit than you might have thought previously from vaccinating teenagers, who obviously tend not to get seriously ill from COVID with the vaccine if you are trying to hit herd immunity. We've seen that the US is recommending the vaccine for all over 12-year-olds, 16 European countries, including France and the Republic of Ireland.
Katie, how is the vaccination programme going more generally? It had been struggling to reach a lot of young people who weren't as young as the group that we're talking about now, but those who were sort of under 30, who may have seen that there or may have believed that there wasn't a particular personal benefit to getting the jab.
Well, I think there's a bit more optimism in government now about the reaching out. I think about recent uptake, it's clearly got to that point where I think that it's more about the government working out how to reach those people who haven't said yes and working out how to give it to everyone who's queuing up. And you're hearing lots about how there's second jabs available if you're at the right gap, even if you don't have an appointment, turn up and take it. But I think, as we discussed on the podcast earlier this week, the fact that the government have moved from not just the stick approach, but also the carrot in the sense of Uber incentives, teaming up in that way, shows I think they're just trying everything to get there. I do think that it feels as though the government's very strong language on vaccine passports for if you need to go to university has softened slightly. And I think that reflects the fact that Boris Johnson ultimately has had a strong rhetoric on this, but it is causing problems in terms of party management, both in terms of backbenchers, but also notably cabinet ministers. If you look at Jacob Rees-Mogg, for example, the fact that he said publicly that it wasn't very British to be using a vaccine passport, I think shows you how hard it's going to be to actually enforce discipline if the Prime Minister keeps going up that path.
James, just sticking with Nicola Sturgeon for a minute, she's on the brink of signing a deal with the Scottish Greens in the Scottish Parliament. Explain what that would mean, particularly for independents.
It's a very good question as well. What I think what it does is a formal agreement between the SNP and the Greens, as opposed to the informal understanding they have at the moment, would allow Nicola Sturgeon to argue that her pro-independence government has a formal majority in the Scottish Parliament. And she will use that to argue that when the Scottish Parliament votes, as it will possibly as early as this autumn, for an independence referendum bill, that it has kind of extra legitimacy because this is a bill from a pro-independence government with a pro-independence majority in the parliament. Now, I don't think that is going to change how the UK government reacts. I think that, you know, I think the UK government feels, as Michael Gove's comments at the weekend showed, that with the polls, more polls at the moment are showing a lead for the union than for independence. But they're quite happy saying, well, no, we're not going to allow a second independence referendum at the moment because it's clearly not the settled will of the Scottish people, to use Michael Gove's phrase. And so I think it is that. But I think also I think it reflects something else, which is I think that since the Holyrood elections, the SNP government have been slightly becalmed. They have slightly lacked a sense of direction. And I think this kind of pro-independence governing agreement, I mean, the hope on the nationalist side is that would give them a bit more sense of direction and purpose. I think that one of the interesting things, though, is to see, you know, what do the Greens get out of this in terms of policy? And does that open the SNP up to criticism from some of the other parties? I mean, there is a slight sense as well, but this period of silence that we've seen on the independence is about to come to an end. The SNP conference at the beginning of September, that's going to have lots of pro-independence motions in it. And if, as it seems, in both Scotland and England, that we are coming through the kind of acute phase of a COVID crisis and we're moving into the kind of longer recovery phase, at that moment, you would think that would be a time when the SNP will try and put independence back on the table. Because, you know, the recovery phase from COVID is going to take years and years and years. I don't think the SNP activist base will want to wait years and years for another crack at independence.
And finally, Katie, there's been a row over the past few days about the government's travel restrictions, with Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson appearing to be at loggerheads. But things have changed in the past 24 hours and everyone is now blaming Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary. What's he done wrong?
I think a common enemy has been found. Slightly stretching it, but I think ultimately we saw over the weekend with the publication of a letter Rishi Sunak had written about travel restrictions that made its way into the Sunday Times. It was being set and pitched as Rishi Sunak ultimately giving Boris Johnson orders or, you know, a strong warning. Now, there was big kickback from the Treasury on this and suggestions the letter had been taken out of context. It was more about actually quarantine rules related to EU and US rather than this Amber Plus list. But I think as the week has gone on, actually you're seeing several cabinet sources now coming out and saying that the Transport Secretary, when it comes to this Amber Plus, this is the one to blame. Now, I think that clearly if it is about a policy in the Department for Transport, you'd think it'd be Grant Shapps who ought to be the most responsible. But I think what has been annoying figures is that when it came to that COVID-O meeting last week, people sat at that meeting were left with the impression that Grant Shapps thought that Amber Plus this was potentially a good thing, not a bad thing. They would give those planning holidays or on holiday a bit more direction as to where that location might be going in a few weeks' time so you can plan a bit more easily. If it's on Amber Plus, then it's probably not a good idea to book a holiday there in 2 weeks' time, but a weekend might be fine. But as I think a backlash has built up on the Tory backbenches, amongst the business figures in terms of the travel sector, and then obviously some in cabinet, it seems as though Grant Shapps is being accused of being a chameleon and now trashing his own policy. Now, I think the Department for Transport are quite keen to stay away from this whole thing, because it's been interesting, because we were talking just before we started recording that Grant Shapps isn't someone who is unused to being criticised. If we look at his previous roles in various governments, all that failed Theresa May coup, if we can remember that one after the conference speech. But yet the Grant Shapps of recent times has actually had pretty smooth sailing in his cabinet role. Nowadays, he's seen as a safe pair of hands. On the days when Number 10 has a difficult morning on the Sundays, it's often Grant Shapps who is sent out to field the questions. So I think this is probably, if we're sticking to the new look Grant Shapps, just a blip, but it gives us a taste of the old days, I think.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.